You're listening to the Wheeler Centre podcast. This morning, we heard sad news. Journalist Mark Colvin, a longtime friend and regular visitor to the Wheeler Centre, has died. In honour of Mark, here's a conversation he had with Sally Warhaft last November about his memoir for our Fifth Estate series. We hope you enjoy it.
When Mark Colvin accepted our invitation to come and make this happen this evening, I was so thrilled knowing that we could end a great year with such a wonderful conversationalist amongst his many other talents. And, of course, if Mark wasn't at work tonight, this room really would be empty. It is bang on time that I'm always glued to PM. It is the one essential radio program for me every single weeknight, and I can't remember life really, or adult life, without it, without Mark's voice. And to have you here tonight, well, of course, hosting PM is just what you've been doing for the past 20 years next year.
Oh, I suppose so, yes.
I think it was
1997, you're right, God.
Time flies, doesn't it, when you're having fun? And but, of course, he worked on Four Corners, Foreign Correspondent, Late Line, 7:30, and in its very first year, Double J, which, of course, became Triple J, the youth station, and helped really get that off the ground. He was the first presenter of probably my second favourite essential listening radio, which was The World Today, and it was his idea, something that you brought back from the BBC as a really terrific listening if you have time in the middle of the day. He is now, though, an author as well, and Mark's written this book, Light and Shadow, Memoirs of a Spy's Son. And in case I forget at the end, Embiggen Bookshop are here. Mark will be signing copies after this event. And it is a beautiful and really substantial memoir. It is a class above any memoir I've read this year, certainly in Australia. But I can't think of anything I've read that's come in from overseas either. It's different. It doesn't follow the normal formulas of a memoir, and I absolutely loved it. Please give him a big welcome. And I want to start, Mark, by this idea that it is not a typical memoir, and that one of the things that really stood out to me about it was how discreet it is. There is not a single name-dropping episode in this book, and you have talked to many, many people. There's the barest of bones about your personal life, just what we think we might need to know, the essentials, and yet it is so intimate. And I was thinking about this, and it reminded me of radio. Because radio, the reason I love the radio is because it's so intimate as well. So tell us a little bit about how you came to write a book with this kind of feel and shape.
Well, I think it's not just about the radio to a degree, it's about the ABC. But it is about the radio too. I have done a lot of television, but I've not done a lot of television in the studio. For quite a lot of my career, I had a degree of stage fright. There's a little discussion in the book about why that might have been, but the stage fright was to do with being looked at by a lot of people. I don't have it anymore. It just fell away about 15 or 20 years ago, and I can walk onto this stage and talk without the kind of fluttering in the stomach or fear of drying up or whatever that I used to have. I never had any stage fright on the radio because there is something about the intimacy. There's something about the radio where you can feel that you are, and it's one of the things that people use in training to a degree. You can feel that you're talking to one person. Mm. It's a good idea to think of your ideal listener or your best friend or your a family member or whatever and talk to them. So radio is about that intimacy of two people talking to each other, but not the intimacy of exposing your feelings or being up there as a as an image in people's head, I suppose. What I'm trying to get at is that I'm not somebody by training or by instinct who wants to bear his soul. And certainly by training, I'm somebody who's spent 40-something years as a bystander writing about other people and trying very hard not to give away too much about what I feel about that person or that situation. Not because I'm unwilling to share that, but because I think that doing that overcommits you. I don't want to be defined by the judgments that I made in 1975, because if even when I was at Double J and covering the dismissal, there's the potential there that you would become defined for the rest of your career as that person who shouted and yelled about the dismissal. I've tried to maintain the principles of good journalism, which are to try and get the facts out, and if you're going to draw your conclusions, draw them at the very end of the process. And so I suppose I was a little reluctant to write a book that was going to be all about me, me, me. You know, the old New Yorker cartoon. Tell me more about... That's enough about me, 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 me. Tell me about you. What do you think about me? I didn't want to write that book. And then I hit on the idea of writing a book which was an intertwining of my career with that of my father. And as soon as it became clear to me that that was a path I could take, then what you had was the possibility of writing a memoir, which was also a piece of long-form investigative journalism. And being in daily journalism now, I've been missing long-form investigative journalism, and there was a lot to find out.
Mm. It is you in a book, when hearing you talk about it, and it's a book where you read it, and, I mean, obviously we all know your voice, but you have the double pleasure of hearing Mark read it to you as you silently read it, which is... really something. Was it a pleasure to write, to be in that process and writing a long book?
Yes, it was. I took time off. It had been a fairly difficult year. The ABC had been under massive attack, direct attack from Tony Abbott. And I got to a point where I thought, I've had this for 40-something years of cyclical attacks on the ABC by various governments of both stripes. And, you know, notably, just in the last week, we've seen Paul Keating come out and have another thrash at us. So there's a totally bipartisan feeling about the ABC, I think, and long has been. And we've had cuts for years and years and years, and I was just sick of it for a while, and I thought, well, I'll take some long service leave and take the time off to write a book. And my mother is going to be 91 in a week or two. She was coming up on 90 then. And because of being in dialysis for a long time, I'd been unable to see as much of her as I wanted to. And she lives out in the country with very bad Wi-Fi. And there's nothing like really bad Wi-Fi for writing a book. If you're looking for writing tips, go somewhere where you can't just log into the internet and spend all day on Twitter, which is my besetting sin, as some of you may know.
The book was launched by Nick Warner, the head of ASIS, the Australia's Foreign Intelligence Organisation. This is pretty rare. He's the only Australian spy who's allowed to sort of be identified as at the top of the hierarchy there. How did you manage that?
Well, it occurred to me that there was a real symmetry there, because his father was Dennis Warner, who was one of the most distinguished foreign correspondents of his era. And his father and my father knew each other. Dennis as a journalist, I mean, he was... there's a great famous photograph of Dennis on the beach at Saipan. He travelled with the Americans through the Pacific during the war. And my dad was in Saigon at the end of the war, and they knew each other. I mean, my dad ended up, when he left SIS, he ended up living in Hong Kong, working for the Chase Manhattan Bank, and they knew each other then in the Foreign Correspondents Club in Hong Kong, and which was a noted meeting place for journos and correspondents. And so he is the spy son of a journalist, and I'm the journalist son of a spy. So it was perfect in that sense. Mm. But also I had met him in 1989 on a trip for Four Corners to Namibia, during which we followed a Namibian refugee back. She was one of the first people back after the South Africans withdrew from Namibia, during the South African withdrawal from Namibia, which had previously been called Southwest Africa and been a South African protectorate. And Nick was there with the Foreign Affairs Department as the sort of organising the Australian liaison. There was an Australian Army group of engineers there as well. And he was very helpful. It was quite difficult logistically for us. He helped us out a bit, and I really liked him. And the thing about Nick is that he had a real sense of, unlike a lot of journalists and spooks, unlike a lot of diplomats and spooks, he was a straight diplomat at the time. He had a really good idea of how journalists work, and he had a really good idea, because of his dad, I think, had a really good idea that that you're much better off trying to cooperate with journalists than you are trying to block them, because if you try to block them, they'll just side-swerve around you. And anyway, he's a really, really nice guy. So I wrote him an email. The other thing was that he'd given a speech about his father, Dennis, at the Lowy Institute. So Michael Fullilove at the Lowy Institute gave me his email. I sent him an email, said, look, this is completely out of the blue, but what about it? And he said, oh, well, I'll have to read it. I'll have to make sure that it doesn't, you know, breach any secrets which our British friends would not want breached. And ultimately, I'll have to get permission from Julie Bishop. So I sent him the proofs, and he said, I'm off on a long flight to somewhere secret, and I'll read it on the plane. And he came back, and he said that he really loved the book and would be happy to do it. And then he went to Julie Bishop and asked her for permission, and she gave it.
And presumably read it as well.
Well, I don't know if Julie Bishop's read it. I've heard no reviews back from that quarter.
It's a thread, and a really important thread through the book is this relationship between espionage, or spies, and journalists. And you describe it as two sides of the same coin. Tell us a bit more. I mean, you make some... obviously, there's... obvious observations that a journalist endeavours to get a big readership or listenership or viewership. You want as many people as possible knowing your byline. But a spy, it's necessarily quite the opposite. But tell us some of the, I guess, deeper things that you've discovered in thinking about this over a long period of time.
Well, I just think that there's the old adage about journalism, which is that, you know, real journalism is about finding something that somebody doesn't want you to know. It also applies to spooks. And a few years ago, I would have said to you that we use completely different methods. But thanks to revelations about the News of the World in London, I think there are members of my trade who have used some pretty awful methods. And, you know, what we know about... there's a guy called Mazen Mahmood who was just sentenced to jail. He was supposed to be one of the good guys in the News of the World stable, and it's now come out that he used not only phone hacking but also techniques of entrapment and pretty close to blackmail. So I think this is not a clean profession, journalism, either. I try to practice it as a clean profession, and everything that I've ever done in terms of training other people and all the rest has been about trying to maintain the integrity of journalism. But in the end, what you find on the ground is that, I mentioned earlier the Hong Kong Foreign Correspondents Club, it was notorious in the Vietnam War that places like that in Hong Kong, in Bangkok and so forth, were places where journalists and spies met and quite often were sort of debriefing each other. And that was sometimes a very unhealthy relationship, but was sometimes a fairly reasonable kind of relationship. But it just depends on the journal. There were people who have been for a long time, people who allowed themselves to be tools of the intelligence services. And then again, the relationship in Britain was so close that there were quite a lot of correspondents for British newspapers and so forth who were known to be and have been exposed since as having been really MI6 all along. And obviously the best example of that is that when Kim Philby was found... The story of Kim Philby begins with doubt and then goes on to the increasing certainty of MI5 that he was a double agent, but MI6 was unable to be convinced about that. So in the end... Yes, because he was taking the advice of MI6 and he went into... Foreign Secretary he was then, he was before he was Prime Minister, but Harold Macmillan went into the Parliament and said there was no evidence whatever that Philby was a double agent. But what happened then was that he'd been blown anyway, and B, they felt that it was, while there wasn't enough evidence to prosecute him, MI5 was not going to have him around anymore. So he was effectively out of the service. So he'd been what they call an intelligence officer, which is an agent handler, and they turned him into an agent. Namely, there was a man called David Astor, who owned the Observer newspaper in London, who had very close ties with the SIS, and they went to David Astor and said, you need a new Beirut correspondent, chummy, and his name's Kim Philby. So he was the Beirut correspondent of the Observer. So he was an agent of SIS, MI6, and continued to do that for quite some time before a bloke called Nicholas Elliott, who was my father's boss at various times, went down, made a real botch of an interrogation of him, and he... disappeared in the middle of the night and hopped on a Russian freighter and ended up in Moscow. So, yeah, there was that. The relationship has been very tangled.
Mm. Do you think... does the life of, you know, your father's working life... Has it ever... I assume you're not an agent, Mark, or a double agent.
Well, I would say you'd be good at it. I would be really bad. Would you? I'm a really bad liar.
Okay.
I'm a really bad liar.
They probably all say that, don't they?
You can see all the signs. The sweat comes up on my upper lip and I can't hold the eye contact.
Well, we could go back to this suddenly not getting nervous at 50, like bang, you know.
Maybe I was turned.
But does it ever... can you see the appeal in it compared to the much more public work you've done where you end up having Tony Abbott and Paul Keating critiquing, you know, the every move of your organisation, that the quieter life of the intelligence officer?
Look, both trades or professions, whatever you want to call them, involve a degree of danger and adventure. And I think that's probably the attraction, if there's a sort of genetic attraction in the two things that binds me and my father, it's that. Dad, somebody said to me the other day, why do you think your father joined MI6? And I said, because he was bored. And a lot of people sort of laughed, and I said, no, seriously, because what actually happened was that towards the end of the war, he'd had a fairly conventional Royal Navy career. And what I've discovered in the book is that round about the beginning of late 1944 or 45, he joined the Special Operations Executive. I think the Special Boat Service, but I've got no precise record of this. But I do have pretty strong evidence that he was running gunboats into Croatia in the first few months of 1945. This is the period which forms the backdrop of the third volume of Evelyn Waugh's Sword of Honour trilogy, because Waugh and Randolph Churchill and Fitzroy Maclean were all in Tito's headquarters with the resistance against Yugoslavia, against the Nazis in Yugoslavia. And Dad was apparently dropping agents in by sea from northern Italy, which by that time had been taken over by the Brits and the Americans. And then he went to Sri Lanka and it was part of the team that was being assembled by Earl Mountbatten to retake Asia, Southeast Asia. And he was dropped into Saigon in about, I think, May or June of 1945 in a midget submarine. And then he was in South Vietnam running a network of agents against the Japanese occupation. And then he was, he actually took the Japanese surrender. He's a very young lieutenant receiving the samurai swords. And then he spent the next year living in Saigon. So it's a kind of, it's an extraordinary, I think a lot of those people who'd had good wars ended up feeling a bit bored by peace. And and then what complicated things further was that his eyes went. There was something that happened to his eyes and he was no longer able to be either a gunnery officer or a flags officer. And he was, if he could stay in the Navy, but he was going to have to be a purser. And if you knew my dad, you'd know what a joke that was. He couldn't do, you know, money just flowed through his hands, really. He wasn't set out to be an accountant. And so I think he was bored. And when he was, somebody at a party said, do you want to come up and have a chat to us? He jumped at it.
And meanwhile, of course, you know, you are born. You are a quiet child, it seems. Quite well-behaved and quiet child. A bit accident-prone, but
terribly accident-prone.
Your own choice to become a journalist was quite accidental, really. And in fact, there's a really curious scene in the book where you describe you've come to Australia and you're at the Dole office. You're at the Centrelink, whatever it used to be, the Commonwealth Employment Service. And you wait in a queue for hours and it's a horrible, dirty office. And finally you get to the front of the queue and the woman says, you've got a degree, you go upstairs. And so you walk upstairs and describe almost what it seems like a different world.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, we were meant to be some classless society back then, but actually all you had to have was a degree.
Yeah.
And in fact, the carpet was laid out and this guy who sounds very important in your life said, you know, talked to you and said, well, come back tomorrow and I'll... And he had three potential cadetships for you.
Yeah.
I mean, that is a what a great guy in your life. What an important the guy, you know, we don't hear many important CES moments, I suppose.
That's right. And I don't even know his name. Somebody did come up to me and say, oh, I used to work in that office. It was exactly as you described it. So that was good.
Yeah, I mean, the two things amazed me. One was that you know, and there you are. The ABC was one of them. I think they all accepted you, but you chose two of them.
No, the Sydney Morning Herald had the good sense to turn me down.
Right. Well, that worked out well for them, didn't it? Yeah. but the other was that sort of that old class system. I guess in Australia, a different version of it.
There were far fewer people with degrees. That's got to be remembered. Mm. There were pretty much no journalism schools. Somebody sent me an email the other day saying there was a journalism school. It was at the Canberra TAFE, I think. There was one in Canberra anyway, but I actually don't think it had started turning out graduates. I didn't meet anybody who'd been to a journalism school for about a decade after that. So the path into journalism was either sign up as a copy boy, and it was mostly copy boys rather than copy girls, this was another bit where I got lucky in a sense, that the ABC, for instance, had for the first time, I was in the first intake of graduate trainees, graduate cadets, because until then they'd been taking on people straight out of school, And I know Peter Cave's a great friend of mine, but he's been quite frank in the past because he was in he'd come in two, 3 years before, and he admits that he was extremely resentful because, you know, he'd done nearly 3 years, and there we came in, and we only had a year's cadetship, and so we were going to graduate at the same time. So that was a bit of luck that they were suddenly taking on graduates. I mean, it's all luck, really. Back then, now it's just, you know, insanely difficult to get into anything. And speaking of class systems, I mean, I think the whole question of internships brings up a whole lot of new class issues. I think what you've got is a situation where people who can afford to put their kids give their kids an allowance and so forth, you're much more likely to get an internship than somebody who is, you know, more financially strapped. It's not a good thing. It's much more of a trend in America. It's been much more of a trend in America and Britain than it has been here. But it's starting to kick in here too. Worries me because you know, journalism. Journalism back then was full of people who had far fewer qualifications, intellectual qualifications, but they were more prepared to sort of kick down doors, as it were. They were, that brings up the image of the News of the World again, and to a degree, which I didn't mean to do, but there was a certain solid practicality about the people who'd come up from being copy boys and learned the ropes, which I think we've lost a bit. I don't necessarily think that journalism graduates are better journalists, or at least I think it would be good if we still had a few people who'd joined the craft straight out of school.
Or cadetships seem or to just, be a great loss, don't they?
Yeah, or just came out of having done an arts degree. Or a science degree. I don't necessarily think that you're going to be a better journalist for studying Lacan and Foucault for 3 years. Sorry.
I'm sure you don't.
Philosophers out there.
How do you feel about having been at the ABC your entire career? This is a big relationship in your life.
It is a big relationship, but it's one that, I mean, you did say that I've been at PM for 20 years and that's the exception that proves the general rule, which is that I've tried to stay out of the ABC in various ways for most of my career. In other words, not be at headquarters. So I did a year's training at ABC News, but then I was at Double J for 3 years, which was very much like being in a completely different organisation. It was totally autonomous. It was like a sort of anarchist collective at times. It was all run by weekly meetings, sometimes more frequent than weekly meetings, where everyone sat around on beanbags and shouted at each other. There were self-criticism sessions, more or less. And there was... But it was actually... It was a lot of fun. I don't want to make it sound like a Maoist village in the Cultural Revolution. It was a hell of a lot more fun than that. and there was also a lot more weed. But... But I, of course, never inhaled. So somebody, a friend of mine who worked in the floor above, said was asked, he was working for a New South Wales minister who had also worked on the floor above, an ex-ABC person. And he, Mark, formulated an answer, should Bob ever be asked whether he'd smoked dope? And Bob was going to say, well, I inhaled, but I never smoked because there was so much just rising up through the floorboards from Double J. So, yeah, the answer is, you know, I did that, and then I was a foreign correspondent in London, and you've got to get away from head office. And then I was back briefly for a couple of years doing The World Today. And again, Radio Current Affairs was kind of quite fairly separate from the rest of the organisation. Then I was Brussels correspondent. Then I was at Four Corners, which was very hived off from the rest of the organisation, partly for sort of security reasons. It was very important that nobody be able to get hold of Chris Masters' files on organised crime and so forth. The security, in those days, security generally was a lot more lax, but security at Four Corners was quite tight. And in general, so, you know, then I was in London again, and in general, I think that I've sailed on a lot of little pirate ships rather than in a big fleet in terms of my career at the ABC, and some of them have been real pirate ships. Double J really was, you know.
Yeah, well, yeah, and I mean, interesting early learning experience for you too there, because you had to grapple with serving a youth audience,
yeah.
But all the newsroom ethics and balance, yeah. And how did you work that out, and how has that stayed with you throughout your career, that sense of thinking that through, that the ABC is not one single entity, it's not one building.
That's right, and I think it was about the word alternative was incredibly popular, fashionable in those days. So it was a question of trying to find alternative ways to do coverage and to do coverage of alternative subjects, which basically at Double J most of it meant doing stuff that young people were interested, which other people weren't covering. I mean, there was an awful lot about schools, for instance, the authoritarian nature of schools back in those days. There was an awful lot about drugs, obviously. Was drugs and sex were really big subjects, and one of the things that which, to a degree which a young audience now would not understand at all. You just were not supposed to talk about sexual health, for instance. Mm. You're not supposed to talk about... it was worse for women to talk about sex than it was for men, too. That was a big taboo, I think. And so the one of the first documentaries that the station did was called The Ins and Outs of Love, and it was just essentially a mix of music and people talking about their sex lives in a very frank way, and it just outraged people, including the deputy general manager of the ABC, Clem Semler, who wanted the whole station shut down, as did Fred Nile. It's amazing, you know, that I found myself writing about Fred Nile and thinking, hang on, he's still there. he's still influencing major votes in the upper house of.
Oh, he says that about you too.
I'm sure he does. Yeah.
Was it being on the ground as a foreign correspondent though that was the most exciting work for you or not? You opened the book with a story from Iran and being invited into the US compound where the US hostages were being kept after Jimmy Carter's failed attempt at releasing them. And these opening scenes of your book are like, it's kind of Game of Thrones. It's like it's really quite horrific what you describe. And it's a great opening, as I'm sure you know, for a couple of reasons. It sets the scene and reminds people like me that you were on the ground at that time, that, you know, you've been doing it a lot longer than I've been listening to the radio. But also you use it as a pivot. I don't want to tell you, the audience, how the book ends, but it's very, very clever that the opening and the ending and the pivots of history that you talk about, and being able to sometimes see in hindsight and sometimes you get a sense of feeling them as they're happening. And I'm wondering, is that stronger and was it more you as a journalist than the desk-bound Mark Colvin of PM?
Yeah. I think from a very early time, because I was, you know, a bit of luggage carried around the world as a child by a diplomat / spy. So I've always had a fairly global perspective. And I think once I got used to the fact that I was a journalist, once I realised that this wasn't something I was going to do for a few months and then drift away and do something else, I think I, even at when I was at Double J, I think I had my eyes set on being a foreign correspondent, partly because certainly in those days, being a foreign correspondent was a license to travel and go and see stuff and try and find out what the world was like, try and find out about what places were like that you'd never been to, or places, or what really happened in places that you had been to, and it was I think young men in their 20s are pretty reckless. I think everybody knows that. The testosterone thing appalls me when I look back at the degree to which I would hurl myself in. I thought that I was a fairly careful correspondent, but I look back at myself and I am quite terrified by a few of the things that I did. And I'm also quite terrified by a few of the things that I walked into and which then turned nasty. I mean, there are occasions in the book where exactly that happens. You walk into somewhere because you think it's completely safe and then suddenly the whole thing shifts. What was the question again?
Well, it was a big question about doing that kind of work, being on the ground, but also to be there in those pivotal moments of history.
Yeah, look, I think that what I think now is to a degree what I've always thought, which is that you don't actually get a good picture of the world unless you have people who will go there and tell you what is actually happening. And I make a fairly passionate argument in the book for having lots of foreign correspondents, having lots of journalists. I think we're in a really dangerous time, not only for journalism but for society, because I think we have a diminishing pool of people who are actually paid to go out there and look at stuff. And at the same time as you have this diminishing pool of those people, and it's a lot of the reason why that pool is diminishing is economic, it's expensive to get news, and at the same time it's becoming cheaper and cheaper to get commentary. So that's been the result of the 24-hour news cycle, that you have more and more people the Americans have that great word, bloviating, which means spouting on, really, about smaller and smaller numbers of facts. And that's been a problem until... That's been the central problem until recently. And I think the problem that we're now facing, I think we're going through a massive shift, another massive shift, is that the cheapest thing of all is just to make it up.
Mm.
So the problem of fake news and the so-called post-truth society is something which I finished writing this book in the middle of this year, and I didn't see that coming over the hill, and I didn't see Donald Trump coming over the hill. But, you know, I look back on the book now, and it is... It has a certain arc which ends at a certain point, and it describes an era. And I've got the feeling now that, you know, volume two is going to be describing how that era went from one thing to another. And I think it has just come to a shuddering halt, and we're entering a new one. I don't know what that's going to be, but I keep thinking about W.B. Yeats. What rough beast... Its hour come round at last is slouching towards Bethlehem to be born.
Mm. Well, that's uplifting, isn't it? That's I.
Or and put it another way, there's a Scottish comedian called Frankie Boyle who says, I heard him the other day saying, "Look at his hair. It looks like the plug hole in an orangutan sanctuary."
The fake news has seemingly caught everybody by surprise, even that on its own. The media have had a very, very rough time in the past couple of months.
Very much so.
Mm. You quote a British politician, Dennis Healey, who talks about the hinterland that politicians... should have a breadth of interests and activities outside of politics. And when I heard you talking about journalists, you know, that they'd be perhaps better with more BAs and general degrees and so on. And I think it's also...
Or BSCs.
But a broad... A broader
training
range.
In how to think, I think, is how I think about it. It's, you know, I've got an arts degree, but it was really... I did... The history of the English language and its literature
at Oxford.
But it is a you know, I could have done philosophy, I could have done PPE or history, or for that matter one of the modern languages. But all of them are basically ways of training your brain to analyze stuff, to take things apart and put them together again. And I've found that. My English degree has done me no harm at all in terms of journalism, because it is, you know, when you've been through that system, particularly at Oxford, where there is a great deal of criticism of your own work, and it's a very luxurious intellectual system where you go into a tutorial, read your essay out aloud, and your tutor and the other student who's in there with you then tear it apart, and you have to defend yourself. That is an extremely good training for journalism, particularly because the next week the other student reads his essay out,
and then it's his turn.
But one way or another, you learn to edit. You learn a lot about your writing, and above all, Orwell talks about how writing that really close relationship between writing and thinking. Good clear writing comes from good clear thinking, and they're inextricably linked. And that's what I'd like people to come into journalism with.
It was enjoyable reading about your time at Oxford after your time at boarding school, which is an account. The book. You do give your reader a rest and pauses before. Unexpected or brutal occurrences, usually to do with the world, but in this case to do with you, where you were absolutely thrashed in your secondary boarding
eight to thirteen.
Tell us a bit about that experience, but also how it's also formed your view of the world and the abuse, particularly of children.
Yeah, look, I couldn't give you a better description of the boarding school I was sent to than to get you to read Evelyn Waugh's Decline and Fall, which was written about a boarding school in the English 1920s, complete with, you know, drunken masters and thrashings and all the appalling things that happen when you have largely unqualified people left in charge, in complete power over very small people who have no way to fight back. And so what you learn from it is a degree it's the wrong sort of resilience. Mm. It has a tendency to teach you to shut down and block out. Having said that, you know, I think there have been times, long periods in hospital and other privations that I've gone through, where I think I've probably survived a bit better and more stoically because of them. But I wouldn't recommend. If I had a time machine, I wouldn't go back and do that again. But there was a lot of really severe corporal punishment. It was really severe, I lay it out in the book, and what happened as a result of it. But the other thing that it does is induce a sort of form of Stockholm syndrome. You know, it acculturates you to the idea that you mustn't tell anybody about this, and that one of the reasons why you mustn't tell anybody about this is because it's a good system. It must be a good system because they keep telling you that it's a good system, and it creates a, when you're very small, it creates a block in your mind as to what's going on. And I was very lucky to be freed from it when I was 13. And I don't know if I'd gone to an equally horrible secondary school, I don't know how I would have turned out. Luckily, I went to an extremely liberal and for the time very liberal and excellent school with very good teachers, where there was no corporal punishment. Above all, there was no corporal punishment. But I think what it leaves you with in the end is, I was talking to Nick Davis about this, who exposed the News of the World scandal and wrote Hack Attack. And Nick says that it was abuse in childhood. He thinks that that's what gave him his sense of injustice and the need to fight against injustice and to the need to fight for people, you know, small people who are in the power of bigger and more powerful people. I think there's quite a lot of us out there who have that sense, who've been through similar circumstances. It's funny, a very, very old friend of mine who I work with at Double J said to me at the launch, you know, it's weird, isn't it? We've known each other 40 years, and I didn't realise you'd be, you know, I went through that, you went through that, and we never talked about it. Mm. You know, it's weird.
Before we go to the audience for questions, there's less than two pages in your book about your health, and I think I'm most concerned to see that you're sitting here alive and looking very well. But I can't pass up the opportunity to talk about being the recipient of a kidney donation, because I feel like you're in a strange situation where you're very private. And so many people with the chronic or ongoing illness, the reluctance to be defined by that. But obviously, to be the recipient of an organ donation is a big, big thing. It's something that's of great interest to me because my father was a kidney donor at the age of 73, a live donor, and he's now 76 and probably feeling better than ever, actually. He loves the annual health check he gets for the rest of his life now. Since they give him a once-over, he never would have got, but that was a donation to my younger stepbrother.
Fantastic.
And so this is a process I've watched up close. And it's hard to have somebody in your position be sitting here in front of hundreds of people when we know that if we surveyed you on the way out, probably 99% of you would say you'd want to be organ donors, and probably by the time that moment came, it had whittled down to maybe 40, and then for other reasons, things lower and lower. So I wonder how you... I think it's about 3 years now, isn't it, since you...
3.5 years, yeah.
How you reflect on it now with time.
Well, you're right. I didn't want to be defined by it. I didn't want to be defined by it in my first book. I think I will write about it in volume two. Hello, Louise. And I'm just, in my mind, trying to construct... to construct a structure for volume two. But I didn't want my first book to be about, being the victim of chronic disease, chronic pain, chronic illness, all of that. But there's a young playwright called Tommy Murphy who's writing a play, has written, is completing a play called Mark Colvin's Kidney, which I find excruciatingly embarrassing.
I think it's got its own Twitter handle
it's
too,
really
hasn't
about,
it?
Oh, well, the Twitter handle appeared while I was under anaesthetic, by the way. So it's nothing to do with me. I was under general anaesthetic for about 12 hours and it appeared about four hours in, I think. So I can genuinely say that I had nothing to do with it. And it really should be... The play should be called Mary Ellen Field's Kidney because it is going to be a play, much more a play about her. She was hacked by the News of the World, but one of the legal difficulties she has is that she wasn't hacked. Elle Macpherson, whom she worked for, was hacked.
And she was blamed,
Elle Macpherson's voicemail that was hacked. Elle Macpherson blamed her, sent her to a drying out clinic, accused her of being an alcoholic. They kept her in for a week or so and said, you're not an alcoholic, you're not anything, there's nothing wrong with you at all. I joke with her that she's the only person I know who's got a certificate that says, you're not an alcoholic. That's quite a desirable piece of paper to have. because it was Elle's phone that was hacked, she has been unable to get... And because Elle Macpherson has refused, even though it's absolutely clear that that Mary Ellen did nothing wrong, Elle Macpherson has utterly refused to help in any way, including giving her access to the hacked voicemails, because Elle got one of the really early big settlements, and there's something in that settlement, and we don't know what. So she was deeply distrustful of the media, obviously, and I tried to get an interview with her, and she took advice and eventually decided to talk to me, and then we became friends. We found that we had a lot of interests in common in terms of literature and art and things like that, and we became sort of pen friends, as we used to call it in the old days, but it's email and Skype and FaceTime now. And we talked a lot, and I interviewed her a few times, and then she came to Australia, and she was very... She's quite superstitious in her own way. I'm not. But she had become convinced that she could give me a kidney. And not only am I not so superstitious usually, but I was also very, very reluctant to have anybody go under the knife for me. But she was very persistent and eventually said, look, it can't do any harm, let's just have the tissue matching. And we went for because we already knew that this is how it first came up. I was talking to her about my blood group. which is a rhesus negative, and hers was the same. So she said, well, and she went on chipping away, and eventually I said, okay, we'll do the tissue matching. And the tissue matching came out so close that it was really uncanny. The doctor said, you may even be related some way back down the line that you don't know. And so eventually I said, okay, let's do that, and let's do it, and we did it, and you know, here I am 3.5 years later. But so Tommy's play is going to be, I think, about that kind of flipping over of the really, truly, I think the word evil is not inappropriate in the circumstances, the evil side of journalism at its worst. But then the relationship between somebody who had suffered the worst of that and
it's somebody... It's not anybody's kidney, is it? It's somebody that you have this deep
to. What you said about your father reminded me too that Mary Ellen had a sister who died in a car crash, and her estranged, the sister's estranged husband, who hadn't been near her for 2 years... but they weren't divorced, came to the bedside and refused permission for organ donation. And I think that's one of the things that drives Mary Ellen. I think she felt the rest of the family were completely on board, but I think she always felt terrible about that. Mm. And she feels that she was able to give some kind of restitution in some way, and I'm the beneficiary of that.
Well, it's a wonderful thing, and it's always a wonderful thing. And in my family, it's been a life-saving and wonderful thing. And my observation of it, Mark, is that it's the recipient. It's a much bigger deal, in fact, for the person who's receiving this than it tends to be for the person.
It's huge. I mean,
this is for kidney donors, obviously.
Dialysis is miserable. It's a rotten life. As I say, you know, I went 3 years hardly able to see my own mother because she lives down near Yass, and I was doing dialysis every day, 2 days, day and a half, and then I went down for Christmas a couple of years in a row because I was able to get relief dialysis near where she was, and then the third year I had to miss out on that because there was no relief dialysis available because we are approaching a definite dialysis crisis. There aren't enough machines, and there are more and more people with diseases like diabetes that lead to dialysis. So something that I'm very, very strong on is not just proselytizing for donation itself, but for just whether you are for it or against it, have the conversation. Mm. Make sure everybody in your family knows what you want. If it's no, then fine. But at least you've had the conversation, and you don't have that thing, that awful thing at the bedside where people are going, well, I don't think he would have wanted that. I don't think she would have wanted that, whatever. We had the conversation. This was very clearly the wish of the person, and then you go ahead on that basis.
Mm. If you'd like to ask Mark a question, put your hand up, please, and an usher will bring you a microphone.
Mark, are you retired now from the ABC?
No, I'd be on air tonight if I wasn't here.
He'll be back on tomorrow night.
I present PM every night.
Yes, so you're somewhat constrained in offering any views about current ABC policy, I would imagine.
I'm not as constrained as some people.
Well, then I'll press on.
Try me, you know.
You appear on both Radio National and local radio, don't you?
Yeah.
I am so disturbed about what is being proposed to the future of Radio National, and also concerned about Jonathan Green to replace him with Tom Switzer. And I wonder... the only new thing that seems to be of significance is that we've got an ex-Google manager now running the ABC. And to me, Radio National is, if not the jewel in the crown, it's one of them that gives us intellectual material and makes us think. And their they're talking about taking it off the air and turning it into podcasts, which seems extraordinary. Would you like to comment on any of that?
Up to a point. I work for Radio News and Current Affairs. I don't work for Radio National. And I'm not saying that to run away from the situation. I'm saying that because I don't know. I haven't been at the meetings. I haven't been at the big group meetings. I haven't heard from Radio National Management. I've obviously heard stuff at second hand. I, too, listen to a lot of Radio National content. I like podcasts, but I also absolutely see the value of what's now called linear radio. It used to be just radio. And I worry very much that if they shift the entire thing to digital, which is one of the things that's been floated. Again, this is not inside knowledge, but one of the things that's been floated is that ultimately it will all go digital. I mentioned earlier my mum out in the country with very bad Wi-Fi, and certainly here you can listen to digital radio on a digital radio. In the country, you have to listen either by paying large sums for your 4G or on the Wi-Fi. Well, the Wi-Fi at my mum's place is shocking, and it's 25 minutes drive from Canberra and 25 minutes drive from Yass. It's not exactly, Dimboola, it's not back of Bourke by any means. So I worry that people will lose some access if that were to happen, but I don't know if that's going to happen. I do think that in general people tend to talk about, there are meetings you go to where people say, oh, we've got to shift more into podcasts, and then you look at the figures for AM, The World Today, and PM, and the podcasts of AM, The World Today, and PM are doing really, really well. And you say to yourself, to their faces, what do you think those podcasts are? They were radio programs. I know people who either listen direct online in London or Washington or wherever to our programs, or download them as podcasts and listen to them afterwards. But I do think that radio as such is important, and I think that it is one of the media where there have been repeated forecasts of its demise. It started in 1950-whatever with the arrival of television. Radio will be dead, but radio lives on. It keeps on living on because it's the medium that you can listen to while you're cooking dinner or driving home. Obviously, a lot of people listen to us driving home. And again, if you're driving from Canberra to Yass on your commute home, how are you going to listen to PM? I worry about that, but I don't know. Again, I am not saying to you that this is what they're going to do, because I don't know what they're going to do. But I'm obviously as worried as anybody else.
I just wondered, your father being a spy, were you actually aware of that when you were growing up, and did it affect you or impact on your life directly?
I wasn't aware of it. I wasn't officially or fully aware of it until I was 25, when I went to stay with him, and he was in Philby's old job, actually, working as the senior SIS representative in Washington, which meant spending a lot of time at Langley. This wonderful thing in Washington, when you've grown up in that British system where they denied, they would neither confirm nor deny that MI6 even existed until I think 1985 or 86, something like that. And then you go to Washington and you're driving around the Beltway and there's this huge sign that says, CIA headquarters, Langley, Virginia. And he spent a lot of time there. He was the liaison between the CIA and SIS. So I was going to stay with him, and he told me that, and sort of swore me to seek lifetime of secrecy, which has fortunately been lifted since. because I was going to be staying with him and I was going to be meeting, there were some SIS people coming through, I was going to be meeting them, they'd be at dinner parties and so forth, and I had to shut up about it. But until then, I'd had some suspicions, but a lot of spook experts had said to me, no, he can't be MI6 because he has been an ambassador. He was ambassador in Ulaanbaatar in Mongolia. And one of the sort of research breakthroughs that I found in writing the book is that it is now known that the embassy in Mongolia is the one big exception to that, because it was set up back in the late 50s or early 60s. The embassy was set up on the suggestion of the SIS, and it was always a co-funded station, co-funded by the Foreign Office, as it was then called, and SIS. And it was its most important function was as a GCHQ listening station, an electronic listening station, for signals between Moscow and, well, between the Soviet Union as it was then and China. And so because he had been an ambassador, I assumed that he couldn't be a spook. But then again, my sister and I had always sort of questioned that, because there was always a lot that was a bit suspicious, but you weren't quite sure. And then eventually, just about 6 months before he told me, my mother gave us the bare bones of the fact that he was MI6.
Another media that people are discussing the potential demise of is Twitter. I'm wondering if you think Twitter worth saving, and if so, can you convince my mother, who's sitting down the front, why it would be worth saving?
Well, I discovered Twitter in 2009, and before that I had thought, just the name is rather silly, and I'd been resistant to it. The name seemed rather silly, and then I thought, oh, it's only 140 characters, and then I discovered that it is actually, like a lot of things on the internet, it is pretty much what you want it to be. I think Douglas Adams said the internet is neither good or bad, it's just humanity. And I think that's true of Twitter as well. And the key thing that I discovered about Twitter was that the 140 characters didn't have to limit you because of linking. And then they gradually refined the linking so that long links would take up fewer characters out of your 140, so you could say a bit more and link to articles. And so I run my Twitter feed very much as almost as if it were a news and commentary service, almost like an old newswire or something like that. Other people do other things. Like, there's a wonderful Frenchman called Jean-Philippe Tonac, who is at In the Mood for TW, In the Mood for who just tweets photographs, paintings, extraordinary little gifs which he has taken. He's either made a Magritte or something into a little gif, or he's taken a little tiny bit of Jean-Paul Belmondo doing something in a film and turned that into a little three-second gif, or just a beautiful, beautiful feed. And so I have a lot of serious stuff in my feed. I have a lot of comedians in my feed, because I like the way that comedians try out their one-liners on Twitter. I have a lot of art and stuff about literature on my feed. I follow about 2,000 or 3,000 people, and it's just zooms through. But you can just stop it and find really interesting stuff. And I also think that I have conducted my Twitter feed in a fairly civil way, and I try to be extremely polite to people, even if they're extremely rude to me, and that seems to be the best way to deal with trolls and make them go away. I'm really pleased that they brought in the mute function, because it means that you can effectively block people that they don't know that they're blocked. I do occasionally block people if they're either rude or racist, a few things like that. I But I do, I mean, I think one of the things you're alluding to is that they've had a really big problem of dealing with trolls. I'm very glad, I'm very lucky in being a male on Twitter. I think it's much worse for women. And I know women whose Twitter handles imply that they're men precisely because of that. And they've tried it both ways and found, you know, it's quite easy. It's quite an easy experiment to do. You can be a male or a female on Twitter and tweet the same things and find yourself getting far more abuse as a woman. And I think Twitter's been very slow to deal with some of that stuff.
It's okay, though, Mark, because Melania Trump's going to sort it all out.
Oh, yeah.
Mm.
That's it. It's great that the Trump family is going to stop online bullying.
Yeah.
That's wonderful, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's just one of those wonderful logical things, like saying that there are 3 million illegal aliens voted so that there should not be a recount. I'm still trying to work that one out. Been trying to work that one out for the last 24 hours.
We have to wind it up. There are so many other things I wanted to ask you about, but I encourage everybody to buy this, and if you buy it tonight, you'll get an autograph, and I'm sure Mark will put his Twitter handle in the pages there for you too, so you can join what's been a seriously thought-out endeavour, your Twitter life, and very important to your work too, obviously. It's just been joyful. Thank you so much, Mark Colvin.
Thank you. Thank you, Sally.
Mark Colvin in conversation with Sally Warhaft in November 2016. You'll find more of Mark at wheelercentre.com. Thanks for listening.